My name is Keith Beavers, and I went to Portland for the first time recently and saw a roller derby tournament game. Why is this not more popular? Oh my God, it's amazing. What's going on, wine lovers from the Vine Pair Podcasting Network? This is the Wine 101 Podcast. My name is Keith Beavers, and I am the Tastings Director of Vine Pair, the Vine Pair. We move further and further, closer and closer to Rhone's fame. But before we get there, we have to talk about a reclusive knight in a new castle. Aww. Amazing how much impact the Roman Empire had on this part of the world. And it's amazing how much documentation the Romans did. I mean, this thing was insanely huge. My God, what an empire. And to show like how much of a grip the Roman Empire had on the world, when the Roman Empire falls, many places go into these sort of power vacuums. Or just even cultural vacuums, or even just like existence vacuums, because documentation just kind of like poof, disappears. And for a place like the Rhone Valley, which is like some of the most, it has some of the most, what I'm trying to say, there's so much human activity in the Rhone Valley throughout antiquity and the Roman Empire and all that. To say that, there's really nothing to talk about from the fall of the Roman Empire to like the 14th century. It's a lot of time. But as far as wine is concerned, there is no real evidence of what actually happened to this place after the Roman Empire fell. Now, because of the Gauls and their ability to make wine, and eventually the Romans learning from the Gauls during, you know, Roman Gallic times, obviously, and when you read this, you know, in the Oxford Wine Companion, when Jedi Winemaster Jancis Robinson brings this part up, she says, and I quote, "The people of the Rhone Valley doubtless carried on winemaking after the Romans left, but we have hardly any records at all until the late Middle Ages." What we do know about wine in France in the Middle Ages, there is some documentation, and we found this out in our previous series, that wine merchants in medieval times, in the Middle Ages, were buying and selling wine from Bordeaux, Gaillac, La Rochelle, the Île-de-France, and the Loire Valley. And nary a peep from the Rhone. But I did find one very important thing that happened between the fall of the Roman Empire and the papacy of Avignon. Because once the popes arrive in Rhone, things really start to unfold. Blanche of Castile, or Blanche de Castile, was the third child of Eleanor of England, herself the second daughter of Eleanor of Aquitaine. Remember back in our Bordeaux series? Small world with the royals, am I right? She became Queen of France by marrying Louis VIII. Now, when Louis came into power, he had some issues going on with the people in the south of France. There was some animosity going on there, some fighting. But the thing is, Louis VIII died in 2026 of dysentery. Ew. And his wife, Blanche of Castile, takes regency. Now, they had a kid who was only 12 years old who would eventually become king, but in the interim, she was the regent in his minority, is how they say it. And not a lot of people like this, but what's really cool about her, just a little aside here, she was a boss. And from 1226 to 1234 AD, she basically was the Queen of France, and she did all kinds of cool stuff. She made sure to placate her enemies in the South by giving people castles and land. She knew how to do diplomacy for real. And she actually, people attempted to kidnap her and her son. But during that attempt, she ended up being able to reach out to the people of Paris saying, please help me protect my son. And she was so popular that the citizens of Paris line the street upon her return with her son from somewhere to make sure that they were safe all the way to the palace. So she was a popular person. She also organized an army around her because, of course, now she has people coming for her. But in another example of her awesomeness, she led a sneak attack by her enemies with her army. And while they were camped out, she went out into the woods with her army to gather wood so the soldiers would be warm. So you get in the drift here. She's really cool. And this is kind of where our story of wine comes into play here. So without getting too deep into history here, she was responsible for the Treaty of Paris. And what that was a way of quelling a crusade in southern France where Christianity was trying to get rid of an offshoot of Christianity that was threatening Christianity called the Carthians. This was kind of a part of the whole thing that was happening before her husband died, Louis VIII, but this treaty ended that crusade. It was called the Albigensian Crusade. Now, the legend has it that there was this knight, this crusading knight, who had come back from the Holy Land, and he approached the Queen of Castile. And he asked her if he could build a chapel to St. Christopher on a hill in the northern Rhone. And I find it interesting this legend mentions the Holy Land when a crusade in southern France had just been stopped. So it could have been the Holy Land or it could have been just southern France. But St. Christopher is the saint of travelers, so maybe it was the Holy Land. But just the timeline kind of just fits a little bit more with the Albigensian Crusade in southern France. Anyway, he was granted this, and he lived as a hermit on top of this hill in a chapel for 30 years until he died. The chapel is still there today, and it is the anchoring image of the wine region of Hermitage in the northern Rhone. So that's something we know that happened before the popes came. And if you look it up online, just an image of this little church, this little chapel, I mean, it just overlooks the river. It's absolutely stunning. But, you know, I can just see someone as cool as Queen Blanche saying, yeah, of course you can have that hill. Sure. And that was the 13th century. Now, the 14th century, something was going on between the crown and the popes. They weren't getting along. The crown was getting a little annoyed at the power of the popes. And the popes were actively trying to control the crown. And it came to a head in the early 14th century where you had this king, Philip IV, and a pope. I think it's Boniface, because that's what, or Boniface, B-O-N-I-F-A-C-E. This guy is like a movie villain. I mean, he had like resting pope face, if you will, and he was constantly trying to bring the crown to heel. And it got so heated between Philip and Boniface, we're just going to say Boniface, that Philip ended up coming to the pope with an army and arrested the guy and really beat him up, like really beat this pope up to the point that after his release, he ended up dying from his injuries. I mean, the guy was just terrible, but like, you know, that's all so messed up. But the thing is, his successor, Benedict, the 10th, it doesn't matter. Anyway, he only was pope for 8 months and then he dies. So the next person to succeed Benedict is someone we know very well from previous series, Pope Clement V. We know this guy. It was thought that around this time that Rome was not safe for clergy. Not only was there this push and pull between the crown and religion, but also there was a lot of infighting between noble families in Rome, and it was just a mess. So when Clement becomes Pope, he became Pope while in France. And he said, I'm not going to Rome. No. I'm bringing the administration, what they call the Curia, to France. And he moved the entire papacy from Rome to Poitiers, which is the area that Eleanor of Aquitaine was hanging out in back in the day. And then eventually to a town called Avignon in the Rhone Valley, what we call today the Southern Rhone Valley. And from 1309, is when Clement came in, to 1376, seven successive popes resided in Avignon rather than Rome, and they were all French. And this part of history with Rome is called, well, it's sometimes called the Babylonian captivity. And when the popes, when Clement and all the entourage got to Avignon, set up and got all this going on, they encountered wine. They were actually very quick to find the local wine and really get heavy into it. Now, the popes are famous for drinking a lot of Burgundy. And Burgundy was more popular than these wines, of course, but 3/4 of the wine consumed in the papal court in Avignon was local Rhone wine. And towards the end of this Babylonian captivity, we've talked about this before, but Urban, which was the last pope to really do all this, came back to Rome for 3 years. And when he did come back to Rome, he brought a vine with him that he called a vine from Côte de Rome. So that's when we start seeing or hearing that term, Côte de Rome, the hills of the Rhone. But the thing about the popes, the papacy of Avignon, is it became so powerful that it took on a kind of royalty itself. They started acting like royalty. And what they did was Clement and his successor, John the 22nd, who was actually the longest lasting pope in this entire papacy, this Avignon papacy, they did the work to centralize and reorganize the administration of the church so that it acted like its own little government, its own little royalty, where they had their own tax laws and they became filthy, filthy rich. More and more French cardinals were brought in, and a lot of these French cardinals were actually relatives of the ruling pope at the time. And there are stories of extreme fortunes being spent on wardrobes and silver and gold plates for banquets. Now, this is, you can imagine Burgundy here, but you can also imagine a lot of local wine because this thing got bigger and bigger. And the story goes that Clement definitely did order vines to be planted in Avignon around their palace, but it is John the 22nd that really is credited for getting vines planted, because what he did in the 14th century is he had a castle built for him about 10 miles north of Avignon. This castle was built in a town called Calcernière, which just means it's a reference to the limestone quarries in that town. And so this new, it was a summer home. It was a castle, but a summer home for Pope John the 22nd. This castle, the summer home, was called Châteauneuf-Calcinière, or also known as Châteauneuf du Pape, the new castle of the Pope. And when he built this castle and is credited with planting the papal vineyard of Châteauneuf du Pape. And until the end of the papacy, which ended with what's called the Great Schism, meaning Rome wanted to have popes and Avignon wanted to have popes. And at one point there were two popes and it just got very complicated. It all ended. It's a whole other part of history. It has nothing to do with wine, so we won't get into it. But the wine in this area, because of this influence of wealth, steadily grew in popularity. Now, in the early days of the Babylonian captivity or the papacy of Avignon, the wines were just called vin d'Avignon. And these wines were actually much lighter than the wines we have today. I mean, it's a very hot region, but this was the Northern Rhone and the Southern Rhone. But it was also a bunch of field blends, probably, I'm guessing, because of all the varieties that are in this area. But eventually, the wines get a little more concentrated because Burgundy starts to take notice. And this is really interesting. As travel became easier, wines could travel easier. The wines that were coming from the Rhone through Burgundy to get to other markets were heavier than Burgundian wines. Now, I'm not really sure if they're heavily concentrated like we see today, or just based on the varieties that were being used, even though they were considered quote-unquote light, they were heavier than what Pinot Noir was making, or the Fromentou Pinot Gris they were making in white wine. And typical of the Dukes of Burgundy, you know, these are the guys that said Gamay is bad for your health and bad for the world and bad for your dukes and all this stuff. They did the same thing with the wines of the Rhone. They called these wines très petit et pauvre vin, which just means very small and, I don't know, I think poor or ugly wines. They were threatened by the potential of these wines being more well-traveled than their wines. So in 1446, the Dukedom of Burgundy in Dijon banned wines from Lyon, Vienne, and a town called Tournon. These are all towns up and down the Rhone in the Rhone Valley that could not get north. And these restrictions lasted from the 14th to the 16th century. And this must be why, when we're looking at the history of Burgundy, we don't see Rhone anywhere. Because as a consequence to this, wines from the Rhone were basically excluded from trade to England and what we know now as the Low Countries, or where the Dutch trade got its start. So Paris is not seeing any Rhone wine, and that doesn't happen until like the 17th century. So it's coming, but not yet. The thing is, though, land travel does get easier at some point for the people of the Rhone, and merchants are able to at least get their wines to the lower part or the southern part of the Loire on that river to get into a trade route. Now, there's a couple things that happen around this moment in time that I'm not really sure about yet, but I want to tell you about them because they're stories. I can't corroborate them, but there's talk of it. So these wines get popular because of the access to the Loire Valley. And the story goes that in 1650, regulations were introduced to make sure the wine from this area was genuine and guaranteed quality. So we start seeing the beginnings of a control. It's also said that in 1737, Louis XV of France decreed that all casks destined for resale should be branded CDR, or Côte du Rhône. I'm sure that's true. I just only saw it in one place. I couldn't corroborate it, but it makes sense. In this entry, it also states something interesting, that the wines are mostly coming from what is today the Southern Rhone, places like Tavel and Lirac. So the papacy is over. Wine is more popular than ever from the Rhone. It makes its way to the Loire Valley. Reputation starts to build. Things are going great. After the 16th century, the ban of Rhone on the river through Burgundy is lifted, and then, of course, and this is really wild because this is one of the first places to actually experience this, 1870 is when the first effects of phylloxera are found in this area, and it changes it forever. After phylloxera, everything we've talked to you about up until now, there are remnants of that, but a whole new set of history tracks are laid down for the Rhone. And I tell you what, let's talk about it next week. Yeah, let's do that. Okay. Vine Pair Keith is my Insta. Rate and review this podcast wherever you get your podcasts from. It really helps get the word out there. And now for some totally awesome credits. Wine 101 was produced, recorded, and edited by yours truly, Keith Beavers, at the Vine Pair headquarters in New York City. I want to give a big old shout out to co-founders Adam Teeter and Josh Mallon for creating Vine Pair. And I mean, big shout out to Danielle Grinberg, the art director of Vine Pair, for creating the most awesome logo for this podcast. Also, Darby Seaside for the theme song. Listen to this. And I want to thank the entire Vine Pair staff for helping me learn something new every day. See you next week.